So friends, my topic is materially the same as the one listed in the program, but just kind of for fun, I changed the title, even though it's the same topic. But the title is a secular university a contradiction in terms? And so it's an open question. But it pertains to the role of theology at the university in the end. As a kind of prelude to writing these remarks, I began to rummage around in university mission statements. Starting from my own, our university mission statement informs the interested public that, quote, the University of Notre Dame is dedicated to the pursuit and sharing of truth for its own sake, end quote. I have to confess, and to my chagrin, that I had always found our mission statement equally parts pallid and desultory. But my brief tour through other university mission statements caused me to rethink this somewhat hasty judgment. The pursuit of truth has fallen on hard times, at least if university mission statements are any indication. None of the Ivy League schools, nor Chicago, nor Columbia, nor MIT, mention either the search for truth or the word truth itself. Some do not even mention knowledge. The mission statement of a school of which I am an alum can serve as a representative example. Quote, Yale is committed to improving the world today and for future generations through outstanding research and scholarship, education, preservation, and practice. Yale educates aspiring leaders worldwide who serve all sectors of society. We carry out this mission through the free exchange of ideas and an ethical, independent, and diverse community of faculty, staff, students, and alumni, end quote. In a way, what's not to like? The world is certainly in need of improving. And yet this statement could be credibly mistaken for the mission statement of an upper-end school of technology, such as MIT, which it actually resembles the mission statement. I have it here if you want to hear it. Because in this vision, the primary goal of the university is defined in pragmatic terms, improving the world, educating leaders who will serve society. Research and scholarship and education are thereby subtly but definitely instrumentalized. They no longer appear as goods in themselves, for the basis on which they would appear as goods in themselves, the pursuit of truth, has been withdrawn. The inclusion of the phrase pursuit of truth, and especially with the qualifier for its own sake, imparts a refreshing humanism to my own university's mission statement, and actually to that of every other Catholic university I looked at except for Georgetown. I use the word humanism advisedly to propose that the pursuit of truth is something worthwhile in the first instance on its own terms. Implies that such a pursuit is satisfying to the human being as such. And it therefore implies a commitment to the human being as in some way, and in the first instance, transcendent of pragmatics and utility, and thus in some way spiritual. Yale's mission statement certainly does not preclude such a view of the human being as permissible for individual scholars to hold and to argue for. But it makes no institutional commitment, and therefore, in spite of itself, lists towards the pragmatic. Notre Dame's statement, which I am for the moment highlighting here to make public reparation for years of internal scoffing at it, it's a personal thing, makes a different choice. It reflects the humanistic view of the university on offer in John Paul II's apostolic exhortation, Ex Cordia Ecclesiae, where we read, quote, with every other university, the Catholic university shares that gaudium de veritate, so precious to St. Augustine, which is that joy of searching for and discovering and communicating truth in every field of knowledge, end quote. Evidently, Ex Cordia was overly ebullient in imputing its humanist view to every university. Or perhaps Is it the idea of a university itself, which has been increasingly subject to diminishment, not to say eclipse, in favor of a more instrumentalizing and utilitarian model in the 27 years since Ex Corte was promulgated? In which case, we must regard the document as in some sense prophetic. I wonder if the mission statements of the great secular universities mentioned above have left behind the idea of the pursuit of truth for its own sake, because it does, in fact, imply a particular view of what a particular view of the human being, implicit in Notre Dame's mission statement, but explicitly stated in the Ex Corte, namely the view that, quote, the thirst for truth is profoundly inscribed on the heart of the human person. And as a token Augustinian at the Thomistic Institute, I have to uplift that. That the thirst for truth is profoundly inscribed on the heart of the human person, and that truth itself is thus, quote, a fundamental value without which freedom, justice, and human dignity are extinguished, end quote. This view of the human being, in turn, implies some kind of metaphysical or at least philosophical commitment to truth as a reality, as not a null set, as meaningful, as having some kind of positive content. There is the additional commitment implied to some kind of systemic or rational coherence to reality, which makes it so the commitment to the pursuit of truth for its own sake is not simply undercut as illusory or incoherent. Notre Dame's own mission statement puts it very confidently, quote, in and through the visible world in which we live, we come to know and experience the invisible God. There is an intelligibility and a coherence to all reality, discoverable through spirit, mind, and imagination, end quote. Ex Corte, for its part, puts it most robustly, distinguishing the purpose of a university from its utility as a corollary advantage. Quote, it is the honor and responsibility of a Catholic university to consecrate itself without reserve to the cause of truth, without in any way neglecting the acquisition of useful knowledge. A Catholic university is distinguished by its free search for the whole truth about nature, the human being, and God. The present age is in urgent need of this kind of disinterested service, namely of proclaiming the meaning of truth, that fundamental value without which, again, freedom, justice, and human dignity are extinguished, end quote. Perhaps I misspoke then. Ex Corte does conceive of the university as having utility, but its usefulness is precisely in its institutional witness to the pursuit of truth as a good in itself, and to the vision of the human being whose dignity is reflected in his or her capacity for joy in the truth, and only secondarily in the practical utility of knowledge acquired or imparted along the way. That this could be a viable, intellectually coherent enterprise implies, as noted, an institutional commitment to a view of reality characterized by an intelligibility that is not simply imposed, and thus an illusion, and therefore not truth. This means a commitment not simply to truths, in the plural, but to truth as transcending all individual truths. That is, to quote Ex Corte again, quote, the supreme truth who is God, end quote. Although Ex Corte is here speaking specifically of Catholic universities, the claim is that this is how the Catholic university fulfills its identity not so much as Catholic, but as a university. It is a claim about what is essential for a university to provide, the cultural service for which it was invented. It is in its precisely institutional dedication to truth as transcendent of particular truths and of their utility, and its concomitant explicit commitment to the idea of God as the supreme truth that permits a Catholic university, that permits a university period, to fulfill and preserve the broadly based humanistic vision that is properly at the heart of a university, dedicated to educating in the tradition of the liberal arts, and to resist a purely utilitarian view of education and the reductionist view of human being it implies. In other words, the pursuit of truth for its own sake is in itself a witness to the idea of human dignity. One cannot improve the world and at the same time violate human dignity, or as Notre Dame's mission statement puts it, violate, quote, a sense of human solidarity and the common good, explicitly employing language drawn from Catholic social teaching. Technically, a secular university could go this far. To conceive of God as the supreme truth, as truth itself, is to conceive of God in philosophical terms, antecedent to any religious specification. For, to bastardize Thomas here, with apologies, truth itself is what all people call God. Yet in point of fact, we see that the most prominent, perhaps definitive secular universities do not go this far, and in fact have dropped the phrase pursuit of truth from their mission statements, despite university mottos such as Lux et Veritas, because it is correctly seen, or at least intuited, that pursuit of truth inclines one to a humanism backed by definite philosophical commitments, even if they are only implied. Perhaps it is not so much of an abuse of Thomas to note that he warned us that the pursuit of truth, meaning God, through the use of reason alone, though in principle possible, would in fact be subject to error in the real world. It would not, in other words, be able to sustain itself. Like a radioactive element, it has a kind of half-life. I know I'm stretching Thomas here. But for the pursuit of truth not to be like an unstable radioactive isotope, reason needs to be stabilized, or it will degrade into a set of incommensurable truths, in the plural. Or, we could say, bodies of knowledge that are verified principally by their utility. We could summarize with a paradox. In a way, to be committed to the pursuit of truth for its own sake means already knowing, in some way, what truth is, or means, even as one searches for it. Excorde puts the paradox this way, quote, the Catholic University's privileged task is to unite existentially by intellectual effort two orders of reality that too frequently tend to be placed in opposition, as though they were antithetical, the search for truth and the certainty of already knowing the fount of truth, end quote. It takes Excorde another four paragraphs before saying what that fount of truth is, because it works its way up, as it were, through the philosophical layers of reflection on this issue I've tried to summarize already. But, quote, by means of a kind of universal humanism, a Catholic university is completely dedicated to the research of all aspects of truth in their essential connection with the supreme truth, who is God. It does this without fear, but rather with enthusiasm, dedicating itself to every path of knowledge, aware of being preceded by him who is the way, the truth, and the life, the Logos, whose spirit of intelligence and love enables the human person with his or her own intelligence to find the ultimate reality of which he is the source and end, and who alone is capable of giving fully that wisdom without which the future of the world would be in danger. End quote. End of a rather dramatic quote. My own university's mission statement echoes Excorde here, quote, a Catholic university draws its basic inspiration from Jesus Christ as the source of wisdom and from the conviction that in him all things can be brought to their completion. As a Catholic university, Notre Dame wishes to contribute to this educational witness, end quote. Specifically, this will entail the creation of an intellectual culture animated by the pursuit of truth for its own sake, but where that pursuit is thematized and grounded in and stabilized by its ordering towards the truth already possessed. This truth is the revelation that reason itself, the divine logos, has become incarnate in an act of loving kenosis, or self-emptying. We thereby know that human reason is most reasonable, most itself, most fully and intimately ordered towards truth and in pursuit of it, when it orders itself through an act of faith towards the love revealed in the incarnation. We can understand why. The love revealed in the incarnation of the Logos, love divine, all loves excelling, is revealed precisely in disvestment, in poverty, and not ownership, in renunciation of a claim to power, rather than the assertion of any such claim, for the love of the world. Reason ordered towards revelation is thus ordered towards a disvestment too great fully to be captured in words. This election of poverty without remainder, this renunciation of a claim to status, rather than the assertion of a status that would trump any other, after all, as God. And thereby, ordering reason towards love of the world without vested interest. I know it's a sinful world, but this isn't about that. From this perspective, the words of Excorde read and reread reveal their profundity on the nature of a university in the context of introducing the idea of a Catholic university. Quote, in this context, Catholic universities are called to a continuous renewal, both as universities and as Catholic. For what is at stake is the very meaning of scientific and technological research, of social life and of culture. But on an even more profound level, what is at stake is the very meaning of the human person. Such renewal requires a clear awareness that, by its Catholic character, a university is made more capable of conducting an impartial search for truth, a search that is neither subordinated to nor conditioned by particular interests, vested interests, of any kind, end quote. Skipping ahead one pope, Benedict XVI, my favorite Augustinian, comments on the incarnation in a way that helps us understand why this should be so. Benedict notes a certain apophaticism attaching to the incarnation, despite the fact that it teaches that, quote, God becomes concrete, tangible in history, end quote. He goes on to explain, however, that, quote, this very God, become graspable, is utterly mysterious. The humiliation he himself has chosen, his kenosis, is in a new way, so to speak, the cloud of mystery in which he both conceals and reveals himself, end quote. This cloud of mystery is the cloud of disvestment, of poverty, of renunciation, of abjection, abjection, to use the language we had chosen above. Benedict concludes that, quote, poverty is the truly divine manifestation of truth. Thus it can demand obedience without involving alienation, end quote. The divine kenosis fulfills and recapitulates all of its anticipations in the domain of reason, its intimations, as Simone Weil would say. Again commenting, this time on Plato, Benedict notes, quote, Plato's Socrates points us to the connection between truth and defenselessness, between truth and poverty. Socrates is credible because his commitment to God brings him neither position nor possessions. On the contrary, it consigns him to poverty and ultimately to the role of an accused criminal, end quote. When revelation is thematized this way, it is easier to see how the notion of reason ordered towards revelation in faith would fulfill rather than negate the mission of a university. And why in Excorde the renewal of the university as university and the renewal of the university as Catholic are inextricably linked as one renewal. The more the university is ordered in all its rational endeavor by institutional commitment and not simply by ad hoc individual commitments to revelation, the more it is ordered towards an impartial search for truth, not pressured by the interests of the will to power, status, and ownership, but precisely as continually exposed to the purification by faith that the ultimate reality ordering the universe is by faith that the ultimate reality ordering the universe is glimpsed in a supernatural gift of renunciation of ownership, power, and status. And in fact, that out of that very gift, the universe arose. Only from this point of view does one have any kind of standard to judge what improving the world might be. And the faith that truly improving the world really matters, really has meaning, really corresponds to truth, and not just to shifting interests of the will to power, however concealed in the package of technological progress and bureaucratic language. It might recognize that giving up the language of pursuit of truth means giving up on truth as an institutional commitment, and so giving up any institutional commitment to the meaning of the human person. The institutional witness spoken of here is the creation of an intellectual culture that performs or incarnates the dialogue between faith and reason. From Ex Corde again, quote, "While each academic discipline retains its own integrity and has its own methods, this dialogue demonstrates that methodical research within every branch of learning, when carried out in a truly scientific manner and in accord with moral norms, can never truly conflict with faith," end quote. An education along these lines is a witness to the unity of all truth and to an organic vision of reality, both of those are quotes, to its intelligibility and coherence. One can easily see, then, how philosophy and theology have specific contributions in creating this distinct intellectual culture. If, quote, "it is necessary to work towards a higher synthesis of knowledge in which alone lies the possibility of satisfying that thirst for truth which is profoundly inscribed on the heart of the human person," end quote, then it is necessary both that the disciplinary canons of each discipline not be violated, for faith does not replace reason, and that there is some kind of transdisciplinary inquiry, I hate to use that word, sorry, that on the other hand orders the results of the disciplines, the truths that they discover, to truth itself, reason itself, and that's philosophy. And then, on the other hand, orders even that order of reflection to revelation, as received in the faith of the church, and that's theology. The word wisdom here is an important one, present, as we have seen, in both Ex Corde and other university mission statements, Catholic ones, and also notably absent in the mission statements of the highly ranked secular schools I looked at. Wisdom comes in the first instance from the traditional vocabulary of philosophy, and therefore from the vocabulary of the striving for an integration that is powered by the liberal arts, but which also transcends them. Classically speaking, philosophy is not one of the liberal arts. That this quest for wisdom is ordered, is itself ordered towards something that does not come in the first instance from unaided reason, but from revelation, does not mean that, nevertheless, theology itself is not a wisdom discipline. It is a wisdom discipline. A sapiential discipline. That theology is a wisdom does not negate its connections to the other disciplines, but features them, and imparts to the whole intellectual life a sapiential character that is properly its own, precisely by ordering it to something that transcends and so purifies reason. We do not say that theology cancels out or leaves behind the results, or especially the questions, of any other discipline. We say, rather, that theology provides a voice, a conversation, a possibility of integrating them, that's the key word, as faith seeks understanding, key expression, of what is revealed, and thereby on another level of what is discovered and left intact as such in the other sciences. I'd like to emphasize, and Ex Corde itself emphasizes, that, quote, "the integration of knowledge is a process, one which will always remain incomplete," end quote. I emphasize this against the tendency to reify integration of knowledge in an accomplished system, which is then taught as such. Integration of knowledge is the name of a quest, more than that of a subtle achievement. Quote, "Moreover, the explosion of knowledge in recent decades, together with the rigid compartmentalization of knowledge within individual academic disciplines, makes the task increasingly difficult." End quote. Not easier. The temptation to reify integration of knowledge in a synthesis of the past or in an imagined settled system of the present is the greatest enemy of the truly dynamic process described by Ex Corde. Apart from the flesh, the world, and the devil. Because it gives impression to those who are not the, it gives the impression to those who are not theologians, those involved in the explosion of knowledge in all its fast-moving complexity, those most likely to know no other academic frame of reference than the strong compartmentalization of the disciplines that does describe the context in which this new knowledge arises. Such people might fear that integration means somehow imposing a synthesis that these discoveries might call into question, and that this then won't be allowed, this kind of questioning. But it's precisely the questions that fuel the dialogue between faith and reason. To name a few, or at least one, do the results of scientific inquiry into human origins cancel out the doctrine of original sin? Students in my classes sometimes point out that they learned in an evolutionary psychology class that because death is part and parcel of the evolutionary process leading up to and including human beings, it can't be the result of sin. Did you know that? It's a settled fact. Nor does the fall of two historical original human beings seem to make sense given current research on human ancestry. Of course, one must always be alert to the categories one is using in research. Human, as a descriptive phylogenetic taxis, should not be confused with human as the philosophical description of a nature. That's a philosophical question that would already show that this particular question cannot be answered simply on the basis of empirical research alone. Because it depends on what you mean by human. But without the philosophical perspective, the question would have no disciplined place to go to be properly asked. But can the results of science cancel out the idea that human reason itself is warped, in curvatus in se, towards the vested, towards ownership, towards power, towards a deformation that is not nevertheless natural? Our ultimate job is not to say evolutionary psychology should not exist as a discipline, long may it live. Oh, whatever. But rather, sorry, do we know our own doctrine? Do we understand it fully enough? Do we really know who Adam is, apart from the second Adam, Christ? The doctrine of original sin is not the only empirically verifiable Christian doctrine, as Reinhold Niebuhr once quipped, because there is none empirically verifiable Christian doctrine. It is not self-standing, but, so to speak, the reverse side of the good news that salvation is offered to all through Christ, quote from the Catechism. Its transmission, the transmission of original sin, is a mystery, which certainly must be tied in some way to human descent, but not thereby reduced to an account of human descent. I'm not solving the problem here, by the way. I'm saying that the process of integration is first and foremost mainly a process, an aspiration, a quest, whose results come partly, but of course not fully, in the separation of questions into different levels, which makes it possible, paradoxically, to have a whole and integrated intellectual life rather than one that is fragmented into rigidly compartmentalized, by which is meant mutually incommensurable, academic disciplines. The presence of a theology department officially sanctioned as such by the university is thus a key element in the identity of a Catholic university. I'd like to say of a university. It is the only faculty that Ex Corde singles out as necessary and comments as follows, quote, Theology plays a particularly important role in the search for a synthesis of knowledge, as well as in the dialogue between faith and reason. It serves all other disciplines in their search for meaning, not only by helping them to investigate how their discoveries will affect individuals and societies, but also by bringing a perspective and an orientation to bear not contained within their own methodologies. In turn, interaction with these other disciplines and their discoveries enriches theology, offering it a better understanding of the world today and making theological research more relevant to current needs, end quote. And I hope the example of original sin sort of shows that. The presence of a theology department thus changes the academic community into which it is welcomed. Or rather, the acceptance of a theology department signals the kind of conversation that the academic community will have and, in a way, will be. The very presence of a theology department, even ahead of any specific results, always both accomplishes and signifies the character of the intellectual life as, quote, a search for a synthesis, as a dialogue between faith and reason, especially when theology is part of the required core curriculum for undergraduates. The theology department is the way an institution orders its intellectual life to the revelation of divine love, a revelation handed down through Scripture and the authoritative tradition of the Church to this day. The accountability of theology to the Church, ironically, is its accountability to the fullest and freest exercise of reason, thereby authoritatively ordered to poverty and not to wealth, to dispossession of status and not its claims, to self-gift and not power, in sum, to truth. Of course, there will be arguments. No one can save us from the work proper to the academy or from ourselves. I'm serious about that one. Discussion, disputation, interpretation, claim, and counterclaim. But the university, ordered by its commitment to theology as a discipline, is ordered beyond itself, such that its disciplines, without renouncing their proper methodologies, do not close in on themselves, but rather contribute to a conversation at a higher level, where their results become questions that leverage deeper understanding of a mystery that will always elude understanding and premature foreclosure of the search through complacency. Theology can get complacent. Through complacency, either of the disciplines or theology, or the reduction of the university to utilitarianism. In the spirit of Thomas, I'm concluding with an academic quaestio. Is the secular university a contradiction in terms? It seems that. It is not. Given the many excellent institutions of higher learning, we see evidently exist and educate at the highest level, conceded. Sed contra, the best of these do not have departments of Catholic theology. I answer that. Without an explicit orientation of the intellectual life, the life of reason, to a higher truth, revealed by God and accepted in faith, which can purify reason and make it more itself, a university cannot succeed as such. But this is supplied by the theology department. Therefore, the secular university, while not strictly speaking a contradiction in terms, cannot fulfill its identity as a university. Ad primum. Of course these schools exist. Yet the impossibility of sustaining theological endeavor with an institutional commitment at these universities means that the secular university has no way of blocking the reduction of the university to utilitarianism and the reductive view of the human being it implies. Therefore, in a way, the secular university actually teaches what, as a university, a truncation of reason it is designed to foreclose. It actually teaches that. Thank you.
I don't know whether Father Thomas Joseph chose this day intentionally, in the liturgical calendar is the day of St. Polycarp. And when I said my prayers this morning, I read the section from the letter about the martyrdom of St. Polycarp. And as he was being led to the pyre, the writer said that he was like a strong ram pulled from the flock to be offered as a sacrifice. And I don't know whether that applies to us or to whom, but sitting in the midst of this secular university. I taught at Notre Dame for 13 years in a theology department, and then I moved to the University of Virginia and was in a department of religious studies. This is the mic?
Yeah.
Oh. Religious studies, and had quite a different experience, and that was my most recent experience. And so I came at John Cavadini's paper with some quite different ears. He speaks from the perspective of a member of a theology department at a Catholic university, and he covers key points about the purpose of a university and the place theology can have. In particular, he gives the search for truth a central place and the mission of a university. The quotation from the apostolic exhortation, Exhortia Ecclesiae, has the nice phrase, Gaudium de Veritate, joy in the truth. And he argues that what should mark a university is its institutional dedication to truth. And he works hard to bend and adapt this central idea to the reality of the university as we know it in this country today, to show how the joy of truth can define not only Catholic universities, but all universities. The mission of the university should be the creation of an intellectual culture that performs or incarnates the dialogue between faith and reason. And he speaks of how philosophy and theology and a theology department can contribute to this culture. And I think he comes at from the right perspective and highlights what is most useful. Yet, as I read the paper, I began to wonder where one can gain a foothold for this argument in a secular university. For example, it is striking that the term truth seldom occurs in the mission statement of our best universities, as he points out. To be sure, there are some, both faculty and students, for whom this is intelligible, the kind of people here, but they are a minority. My experience has led me to view the university as a mission field. In the words of the hymn, where the gospel day sheds not its light. That was supposed to be a joke. The self-understanding of the modern university floats free of history, tradition, and culture, which means that there are few locales in it where exists the intellectual or moral framework in which truth, with a capital T, can be discussed. Nor is there the desire or the will to seek truth with a capital T. For many, that is not the purpose of the university. I read something this week about the decline in enrollment, especially on the smaller liberal arts colleges. And I think this was an administrator at Clemson, and he was boasting about how they were doing. He says, because a successful university, he said, must get jobs for people. I remember hearing once from a graduate of the University of Virginia. He was at a meeting, the president at the time, John Casteen, was speaking in Richmond and was making the big point about all the jobs that the graduates of the University of Virginia could get. And he raised his hand and he said, but Mr. Casteen, I didn't think that was the purpose of the University of Virginia. not only are the students goal-oriented, so also are the faculty career-oriented. In truth, the word, in fact, the word truth has been banished from elite speech. Few universities have theology departments. Theology has been replaced by religious studies. When religious studies was introduced into American universities in the 1960s and the 1970s, most of the faculty were products of Protestant seminaries or divinity schools. This gave theology, biblical studies, the history of Christian thought, ethics, a central place in religious studies departments. This was certainly true at the University of Virginia, where I taught. But as the decades passed and faculty retired or died, the complexity of the department changed. Theology and related disciplines began to play a much lesser role, or no role. Affirmative action appointments increased the number of faculty without rhyme or reason, Caribbean religion, religion and gender. I looked at the course listings for my old department at UVA. 8 courses on Buddhism, 10 on Christianity, I think one had a course on Protestant theology, 4 on Hinduism, 3 on Islam, 7 on Judaism, and 25 on general religious studies. Religion and violence, religion and self, whiteness and religion, blackness and religion, bioethics. So we must begin with the acknowledging that in the American university today, Catholic theology, where it is present at all, is at best a muted voice, and will remain so, except in groups convened for that purpose, such as the one convened today. This is the case, even though, to take again the University of Virginia, 30% of the student body is Catholic, or more. But that demographical fact has no bearing on curriculum or faculty appointments. The idea that a university course should help to form a student is the relic of a bygone era. Early on at UVA, I was brought up short when I mentioned in a faculty discussion that I thought the department had a special responsibility to give students in religious courses an understanding of Christianity as the primary religious and intellectual tradition in which the university stood. And not incidentally, that we were located in the South and many of our students were Christians, evangelical Christians. Well, my colleagues reacted as though I had told an off-color joke or something worse. Once it was thought that a way of inserting Catholic thought into the modern university was by chairs of Catholic theology. But these did not fulfill the hopes of their architects and donors. A single faculty member can have little influence outside his department or his discipline, and when the time comes for a successor, the original dream behind the chair is ignored. That is why Catholic institutes began to be formed, freestanding centers that promote Catholic intellectual and cultural life in secular universities. The granddaddy here is, of course, the Lumen Christi Institute of the University of Chicago. We established one at UVA called St. Anselm, or in a different form, the Thomistic Institute. It seems to me the most promising way to make Catholic theology and culture an integral part of university life, through public lectures, colloquia, seminars, and the like. They not only bring outstanding Catholic scholars and thinkers to campus, their events become gathering points for interested students and faculty and create a kind of intellectual community. Of course, Cavadini knows this, and his paper deals with the intellectual challenges, not so much the concrete realities. To that end, he sets forth aspects of Catholic thinking that is most suited to the university's search for truth. And he puts it nicely. the pursuit of truth means already knowing in some way what truth is, what it means even as one searches for it. The goal is to unite in one person the two orders of reality that are too frequently placed in opposition one to another. I sometimes think that the role of Catholicism in the modern American university is to be a repository of memory. If we lose contact with the past, the worlds we have lost, we are condemned to live in a two-dimensional present, and our world becomes flat, lacking depth or height. Catholicism can be a constant reminder of the intellectual tradition that arose in the West, which has influenced not only the founding of universities, but still is a profound influence on the arts, literature, poetry, music. But amnesia is the fate of the modern university. I was reminded of this 2 weeks ago when I read an essay by the Harvard professor Steven Pinker in the Wall Street Journal, in the review section that comes on Saturday. I think it was 2 weeks ago. It was a summary of his book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Here's what he wrote. Our ancestors, recent ancestors, replaced dogma, tradition, and authority with reason, debate, and institutions of truth-seeking. They replaced superstition and magic with science, and they shifted their values from the glory of the tribe, the nation, race, class, or faith towards universal human flourishing. Where's my water here? When I read this, I thought of a passage I read some years ago. People are fully alive to the danger of superstition in priests. In the course of time, they will find out that professors may be just as bad. But his words, at least for me, were suggestive. Perhaps the time has come for a good dose of historical and cultural realism, and for Catholicism to defend the three things he mentions: dogma, tradition, and authority in the intellectual life of the university. Take dogma, for example. Flannery O'Connor once wrote, "There is no reason why fixed dogma should fix anything that the writer sees in the world. On the contrary, dogma is an instrument for penetrating reality." Dogma is an instrument for penetrating reality. The term dogma comes from the Greek word for opinion, doxa, but it differs from opinion in that it is tested by experience and criticism and is the confession of a community of belief and practice that has been worn through the passage of time. Its strength is that it is fixed, that it has proven itself, and it has been able to reach across generations. Cabedini doesn't speak about dogma in the technical sense, decrees of the ecumenical councils, but he says pretty much the same thing in his discussion of truth. The institutional dedication to truth is transcendent of particular truths. God is the supreme truth that permits a university to fulfill and preserve its humanistic vision and to resist the utilitarian vision of education. That is something we need to relearn, and the university needs teachers to teach that. The same way his second word, tradition. Tradition is an essential component of the intellectual life. Santayana once wrote, "The life of reason is our heritage and exists only through tradition. Again, to use a phrase from Cavendish's paper, reason needs to be stabilized. And that is what tradition offers. In its most basic sense, tradition is the refusal to submit to the arrogant oligarchy of those who happen to be living now. Reason, tradition is a refusal to submit to the arrogant oligarchy of those who happen to be living now. Without tradition, learning is arduous at best, impossible at worst. In most things of life, learning to speak a language, making cabinets, playing the violin. The only way to learn is by imitation, by letting someone else guide our movements. The reason, I suspect, is that it is only in the act of doing and participating that we know truly and understand. It's like trying to change a tire on a car with the owner's manual and never having done it before. Or trying to put together something that comes for your child at Christmas time. And it's only in the act of doing and participating that we truly know and understand. To do something well, we must first give ourselves to it. We cannot begin with questions, but must first bring love. Eliot made this point about literary criticism. You don't criticize an author to whom you have never surrendered yourself. Only then are you able to step back and find what you have to say. A unique feature of Catholic intellectual life is that one always begins with what is given. And only after mastering that does one go on to discover what must be said anew. Finally, Pinker's third word that he so scorns, authority. In On True Religion, Augustine said that authority invites trust and prepares human beings for reason, which then leads to understanding and knowledge. The term comes from the Latin auctor, author, could designate a magistrate, a writer, a witness, someone who signs a will, someone who is worthy of trust. But Augustine then goes on to say, reason is not entirely absent from authority, for we have to consider whom we have to believe. Fundamental truth, you don't begin with the truth of things, you begin with the person from whom you receive it. The purpose of authority is to clarify and illuminate, and its instrument is explanation and argument. St. Thomas once wrote, if the teacher determines the question by appeal to authorities only, the student will be convinced that the thing is so, but will have acquired no knowledge or understanding and will go away with an empty mind. The doctrines Catholics confess and the ideas Catholic tradition have handed on have all been the subject of rational and philosophical criticism and scrutiny for a century. Religious convictions do not operate outside the warrants and other areas of thought and experience, which means that they have a place in the university. Truth, the truth of God, inspires us to pursue truth, for it is in knowing that we seek to know. This paradox is at the heart of Catholicism in relation to the modern university. Thank you.
Dr. Cavendini, I was wondering, because I thought it was interesting as you were talking, considering that you're a patristic scholar, but the picture of theology and its relationship to the university was one that was a medieval or 12th or 13th century and after picture of how theology and the rest of the disciplines are related, whereas for the fathers, they weren't doing theology in the university. Theology was done within the context of the church. You know, Augustine, for example, so much of his theology is sermons or treatments written for quote-unquote pastoral subjects, one might say. Can you speak to then how the church and theology are related vis-a-vis then the university, and if that might change the picture you gave, like a patristic way of doing theology,
Okay, that's a good question. Thank you. My first, like, it comes into my head, is that the university really is a medieval invention. And theology as a school subject is a medieval creation. And Thomas is the first, the famous first article of the Summa talks about why theology? So in some sense, I think that we're always interpreting that and trying to creatively bring it forward to our own time. And I think we can't stop using that language, and we can't stop using that thematization if we still want to be a university. So that being said, theology being what Thomas says it is, I think, relies on, has its source in scripture and tradition, in the authoritative revelation of the Word of God as it's transmitted in scripture and tradition, and as it is served by the magisterium of the church. So to receive the fathers as authoritative tradition, as in some ways, inspiration, source, really doesn't, I don't think, in any way negate the idea of the university. I think the more patristic, the better. I'll give an example. Biblical scholarship nowadays is kind of a thorny issue. I suppose it's largely, at most places, including Catholic schools, dominated by aggressively secular methodology. But if Dave Verbum says the soul of sacred theology is sacred scripture, the soul of a sacred subject can't be a subject that's exclusively exclusively secular, because you're just making Lessing's ditch wider and wider. How are you going to jump across it? But and so I'm distinguishing, in a sense, practice from theory, because the theory is there, it seems to me, to go farther, and this in Dave Verbum. And so no matter how deformed it seems to me a Catholic theology department might get, there's a theory by which it can reform itself, which is different from a secular school, as Robert was pointing out. I'm well aware of the pathologies of Catholic education. But the fathers, in this case, in this specific example, are a great resource, because they help us see how the text has been received by the Spirit-inspired community, and the insights that have been generated about the text precisely as scripture, not just as ancient text, but as canonized, as received in the church. And I'm not saying that we repeat patristic exegesis, but nevertheless, we can receive it as something which can give us, can expose us to a sophistication that we're not used to, and that can somehow perhaps draw up the secular discipline of biblical studies into an authentically theological endeavor. I don't have a roadmap for it, but you have people at Duke working on this in their own way, of course, in the Divinity School. And I think this is a cutting edge of biblical studies, biblical theology. And all you young people are the people who are going to do it. And how are you going to do it? You're going to do it on the basis of authoritative received tradition, which you, like Robert was saying, you learn, but of course you subject to all the questioning that the secular disciplines have. That's what a university is. So you don't reduce it to those disciplines, but you receive the questions and use them to more deeply understand what the very theological project. That's a very long and wandering answer. I hope it helps.
Thank you. This can be addressed to both of you. I was wondering if you could elaborate more on what you would conceive the nature of truth that can be both possessed and pursued in a way where if we think of truth and unity as convertible and yet the integration that we're seeking is never fully achieved and is in fact a temptation against truth. What does it mean then to possess or participate in truth when we're always on the way? And yet we still have this paradox in play all the time where we do in fact possess it. Maybe just one more way to ask the question. If we think of truth as an adequation in some sense, and we want to think of it as sometimes being completed so we can know things truly, how is that actually achieved when in fact truth is always developing? Truth is mystery, truth is God, and transcendent.
Can I give a quick answer? Then Robert's better on this than I am. I'm gonna point to the Catechism. What about the Catechism? If you study sections 65 and 66, which are under the rubric of Revelation, so section 65 talks about how in Jesus Christ we have the fullness of truth. There will be no further public revelation. It quotes John of the Cross commenting on Hebrews 1. That in Christ God, the Father has spoken his word entire and full, and there will be no other word that comes after it, in a sense. And yet the next article says, nevertheless, what's revealed has not been made fully explicit, and the church has all of the centuries of its existence to come to a deeper understanding of what's been revealed. And so I take it, you know, that on the one hand, we possess the fullness of truth, but the fullness of truth is, which is what? That God gave himself in the incarnation completely, and not even God can do more than give himself completely and fully. That's the definitive revelation. Yet if it is that, it certainly implies lots of answers about the worth of a human being, etc. But if it really is that, it's got to be. So it's got to be ultimately something you're always growing into. Reason is stabilized by the quest to grow into that truth and to see reality from the perspective of that truth. And I don't mean at all to convey that there are no answers, but in every age, those answers have to be re-articulated, recovered, because the questions change. Nobody knew about evolution, at least in the same way we do. You know, Augustine had a theory of it, sort of, but not in the same way. And so to understand that truth more deeply means receiving these questions, which sometimes seem very critical, and not saying you can't ask those questions, but then trying to figure out what the answer is now, because revelation has not been made fully explicit, i.e. an address of these questions, to make it something that you're offering to students and to others. Like Jesus says in the gospel, you give them something to eat. But of course, he provides it when you... I don't know, that's my answer.
Well, I think of the words of Jesus in the Gospel of John. He says, I am the way, the life, and the truth. And yet, he also says in the Gospel of John that the Spirit will come, and the Spirit will lead you into all truth. So clearly, truth, on the one hand, is a reality, a given, but truth is an unfolding, a deepening, an enriching of what it is that is known. And it depends on what kind of truth one is talking about. I mean, the truth of human experience. We all know that as the years pass,
the things that we knew and experienced at an earlier age now have a wholly different meaning. So the truth that we knew, 16 or 18, and the truth that we know at 30 or beyond, I would say to my students when we read the Confessions of Augustine, this book is not going to have the same meaning to you if you read it 20 years from now, because you will be different. And so truth is reciprocal. It's not something that stands out there. It is something that enters in, and as one receives it, the truth then takes on a depth and a meaning. The same thing with, I read probably for the third time Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov a few years ago. And it's a wholly different book when you read it later. So I think in that sense, truth is, that nice phrase that Flannery O'Connor used. It helps you to penetrate more deeply into reality. And that's our common experience as human beings, is that we can penetrate more deeply. Now, if you're talking about mathematical truth, there you've got things that are of a different order, or some kind of empirical, statistical truth. But that's not what the Gospel of John is talking about. So I don't see any, I don't even see any tension there. Simply to me, that is the nature of the human mind and the imagination. We bring something, and what we bring will change what we receive. Those of you who teach know that. You have to have a receptive heart and mind.
Professor Powell, I saw your hand.
Yeah, please. Maybe I'll start reading a short passage. Most of you will know it, but just to frame the question. It is interesting to contemplate an entangled band clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing, with bush on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. Think a little bit. There is a grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed laws of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Of course, it's the closing paragraph of Darwin's Origin of Species. And the question, I think, that I wanted to frame follows rather well from this as from many of his writings. It's this. When we speak of secular disciplines, I think we risk, in a way, writing off far too much right from the start. Darwin, though he obviously was very critical and justly so of, say, Paley's construction of natural theology, in fact strikes me as someone who would very much have met the criterion of, say, Notre Dame's mission statement of a pursuit of truth. There are few more admirable cases, I think, of the scientist looking patiently, undesigningly at natural forms and trying to understand them. And I think Darwin is fascinating because he is also, in many ways, the kind of paradigmatic, sort of offers a paradigmatic form of inquiry in which a lot of 20th and 21st century features of university knowledge are not yet in play. There is no concept of professionalization. Darwin doesn't operate with a concept of copyright. He doesn't seek to have his knowledge patented. He doesn't have a patented or a sort of proprietary view of it. He's in fact reluctant, famously reluctant, to publish what he has found for many reasons. So I see in him, and obviously his stature and his influence is beyond dispute, I see in him, in fact, embodied in this supposedly most secular of sciences, I see in him embodied in it, in fact, many of the sort of intellectual virtues that I think would flow right out of a classical, even the Platonic tradition, but certainly would also have been fully articulated in Aquinas. So my caveat here is simply that disciplinarity in the way that I think the increasing amalgamation of the modern university with the political economy of our time has sort of shaped and misshapen it is actually a very recent phenomenon. The rise of empirical sciences is a much older thing. And for a very long time, both within and outside the university, these empirical sciences actually unfolded in fundamentally compatible ways with theological forms of inquiry. So we are really in some ways looking at a fairly recent distortion of a certain form of knowledge. And it is interesting actually to see that one of the forms of sort of, you might say, Darwinian science that now goes by the name of basic research has actually had increasingly a hard time securing funding because it cannot be instrumentalized in the way that a lot of knowledge now is supposed to be. So I think the tension is rather more complex than the phrase secular science might suggest.
I mean, I think that's a very astute comment because it shifts away from the point that John made and I made, the instrumentalization in terms of the student and vocation, and moves it into the very character of the university, even in all those disciplines that one would not expect it to be the case. So the problem is much greater than anyone is acknowledging.
Take one last question.
Hi. Yeah, I completely agree with the claim that the word truth has been banned by elite speech, and I also see a utilitarian mindset as being a problem with the university. But I'm wondering if the fact that a certain liberal secular elite has banned the word truth might not mean that they have no conception of truth, because it seems to me that one of the problems that you have going on, and I'm speaking also from the perspective of the humanities, is that there are very hard and fast truths that are just sort of not stated, or they're sort of like an implied orthodoxy. And it comes across, I think, very starkly in classroom seminars and also in settings like the writing studio where you have weekly staff meetings that actually have nothing to do with writing but are more along the lines of certain, you know, political ideologies. And disagreement is not permitted. So the model of like endless dialectic or like endless skepticism is actually the antithesis of what's going on within the university. And I think a phenomenon that we see arising out of this is the move towards instrumentalization of education, partly economic, this has already been stated, but partly also I think an avoidance of the humanities precisely because they're no longer liberal dialectical settings, but this other kind of hard and fast leftist. So I'm wondering if the move to invoking the term truth and actually pushing these speakers who own up to truth might make the problem worse or might not necessarily correct it, because it seems to me that they're not exactly pushing away from truth, but rather pushing an agenda of truth, just not calling it that.
Well, that's why I shifted the conversation to dogma, tradition, and authority.
I don't know if bringing up the problem in terms of skepticism versus truth might serve as a corrective to this, but perhaps only exacerbate the problem. I'm just wondering, how do you avoid a situation of a will to power where you have two different entities that both have a very hard and fast set of truth, notion of truth? I mean, you're sort of the only outcome of that, then, is who has the most administrative power, right? So I'm wondering, like, from the position of just sheer rhetoric, like saying we should care about human dignity, I feel like we might get a response from the left saying we care about human dignity, that's why we hate Catholicism. And again, I'm entirely sympathetic to the things that you guys have been saying, but I'm wondering if that might be a problem.
Yeah, it's a real problem. I mean, it's what you encounter in classrooms, including at Catholic universities. So it's not. But the thing is, the basic problem, I think, is the foreclosure of reason, the foreclosure of the intellectual life. And there isn't, like, there's not an instant answer to it. You can't just say, well, you can engage in an argument, like you're pointing out, but a lot of times the people with more money win out. And more power. But I can't give up on the idea that a scholar who operates from a larger vision over time, and with a framework that makes us coherent, such as John Paul lays out, doesn't present a witness that is potentially culture shifting. And if I didn't think that, I would not work at a Catholic university. But it's not an immediate solution, and it doesn't feel very comfortable. But to recover, like even what Professor Au was saying, a sense of the other disciplines as not necessarily simply secular, that requires a perspective from which you can see it. So. And that can only be revelation, ultimately, somehow. But it's not something that's a formula. You have to develop this intellectual culture. People have to work at it. And yes, it is about conversion in a certain sense, appealing in the way that universities work, you know, on intellectual grounds, to what truth is. I also think that since at the heart of the Christian revelation is what I've been trying to say, a disvestment. I mean, this is honored, of course, in the breach all the time. But the fact that that's what reason, which receives revelation in faith, is ordered to, I think, bottom line, is ordered towards a razor, towards a critical, towards a critique, towards a purification, and that we just have to work at that, and we can't give it up. That's not a very good answer. But the problems you're talking about are not going to be solved without, like, it's not just intellectual, it's sacrifice, right? You have to put yourself in the situation, and you have to work at it, and you have to give yourself to the truths from which a better intellectual culture can arise. It's like Peter Morin said, trying to create a society in which it's easier to be good. So not creating a utopia, trying to create a university in which is easier to pursue the truth. And maybe more efficacious. Seems like a reasonable
Professor
goal.
Professor Griffiths has a brief point on this.
No. Sorry.
Yeah, I'll be really brief. I'd like to pick up on the last point because I think it's important. So I would much rather, bracketing for the moment the question of Catholic universities, a separate issue here, I would much rather work in a secular university that had a minimal or purely formal self-understanding than I would work in a secular university that elevated the virtue of truth. And the reason is exactly this reason. The reason is that, in fact, secular universities increasingly do elevate a certain understanding of what truth is in its pursuit and use it as an instrument exactly to make impossible certain kinds of intellectual life. By contrast, the university that is unified only by a computer networking and a set of buildings doesn't do that. It lets you do whatever you like. I'd much rather work there.
I think that libertarian point is very interesting. I mean, I think we probably should be talking about that a little bit more later on in the day.